a YA historical novel about a Chinese-American lesbian.
We've been marginalized by historians. So there is gay history, you know, that is a field of study, but that has tended to be done by white historians who don't study people of color. And then we have Asian American history, which is a thing that is studied, but those historians tended to be straight, so they didn't study gay Asian Americans.
That's Melinda Lowe talking about her award-winning novel, Last Night at the Telegraph Club. Then Syed Massoud's new novel, The Bad Muslim Discount, helps us understand what unites us by understanding our differences.
Other people's stories are always incomplete for us because as human beings, we struggle to understand ourselves, much less other people. And so The Bad Muslim Discount, there's some irony in the title, as you can tell.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's 1954, and Lily, a Chinese-American teenager in San Francisco, is discovering her sexuality, she likes girls, and her interest in aerospace engineering. Neither interest goes over well with her family. How she navigates the conflicting poles of family, a budding romance, and her identity as a person is explored in Melinda Lowe's wonderful novel, Last Night at the Telegraph Club. Ms. Magazine called it the queer romance we've been waiting for. But it's much more than a romance. Lowe's novel is a portrait of a time and place that few people know about, the San Francisco lesbian community in the midst of one of the most repressive eras in American history, told from the Chinese-American perspective. Now out in paperback, Last Night at the Telegraph Club won the National Book Award, the Stonewall Book Award, and the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, among others. Melinda Lowe, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Last Night at the Telegraph Club is a young adult novel, but I don't really think it's totally confined to that demographic. It has a wealth of historical information that refers not only to gay life in the 1950s in San Francisco, but also to other things of importance to women's history, that is also women's involvement in early aerospace and in this country. But it is really focused on being a queer coming-of-age story. It takes place in mid-1950s in Chinatown in San Francisco. So first, tell us just a little bit about the setting, both the time and the place.
Well, as you said, it is set in San Francisco in the 1950s, specifically 1954 to 1955, although there are a few kind of flashbacks to different earlier time periods. It predominantly is set in the Chinatown and North Beach neighborhoods in San Francisco, which is where the main character, Lily, lives. And she goes to high school in San Francisco. So that is the general locale. The Telegraph Club itself is set in North Beach on Broadway in San Francisco, where in the 1950s, there were actually quite a number of lesbian bars right along that block.
And tell us a little bit more about Lily herself and her family.
Sure. Lily is a 17-year-old Chinese-American girl. She is kind of obsessed with rocket science because her Aunt Judy works at the Jet Propulsion Lab as a computer. So Lily has always really been drawn to space science. She's very interested in astronomy. So she's really interested in that aspect of her school life. She wants to be a rocket scientist. So she loves that, but she is also starting to realize that she might be a lesbian. And when the book begins, she is at her best friend Shirley's family restaurant, and she finds an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle for a nightclub, the Telegraph Club, they're advertising the performance of a male impersonator. That's what we would call drag kings today. And Lily kind of recognizes something in that that she's interested in. And so she tears out the ad and kind of keeps it. And that kind of reflects something she's been doing for a while. She's been finding little bits and pieces of pop culture that speak to her in a queer way, even though she doesn't have words to describe it as such.
And so she sees this advertisement in the local paper. How common were male impersonators or drag kings at that time?
You know, it's funny because they were pretty common. I mean, they advertised very openly in the Chronicle, and they were a big part of San Francisco's entertainment tourism industry. There were several clubs that had male impersonators, and there were several more who had female impersonators, you know, what we would call drag queens. One of those clubs, Finocchio's, was open then and is still open today, I believe. So this was just part of San Francisco. It was, people went there for this stuff, and it was certainly not unusual. I won't say it was mainstream, but it was not hidden.
It wasn't hidden, and yet there was a lot of repression, in fact, in those days.
Yes.
What do you make about this covert, overt duality and what it says about attitudes towards gay people in America at that time?
Well, I think specifically in the San Francisco context, you have to realize that San Francisco has always been a kind of town where anything goes. And people who were LGBT queer moved to San Francisco knowing that it was this kind of a place. And I think it's had that reputation since it began in, you know, since the gold rush years in the 1840s. It was a town where you could do almost anything you wanted. That doesn't mean that it was acceptable. I mean, there were laws on the books that made it illegal for people to cross dress. So even though there were male impersonators and female impersonators, and they could perform on stage as a show, you know, when they stepped off stage, they had to be gender conforming. So one of the things I learned was that those who did cross dress, who had gender non-conforming appearances in their personal lives, they had to make sure to wear like 3 articles of underwear that conformed to traditional gender norms, so that if they were arrested, they could, you know, show that they were not cross-dressing.
Wow. It was illegal to cross-dress?
Yeah, all the way through pretty late. I don't remember the date right now, but it was something astonishing. It was like in the 70s or something like that, where those laws were removed.
And you did a huge amount of historical research, but you had a lot of trouble finding information about Chinese American gay women at this time. Why do you think that was so? And what did you ultimately, what were you able to uncover?
Yeah, you know, that was really hard. And I think because, you know, research into marginalized communities is difficult to do in the academy. I mean, we've been marginalized by historians. So there is gay history, you know, that is a field of study, but that has tended to be done by white historians who don't study people of color. And then we have Asian American history, which is a thing that is studied, but those historians tended to be straight. So they didn't study gay Asian Americans. So in order to find that kind of crossover, it was really, I really had to like look at the footnotes and find any little mention of someone who might cross those categories, gay Asian Americans. And I did find them in the footnotes. It's really interesting how they were so clearly marginalized, even in these histories, in these academic histories. So I would follow those footnotes to their sources. You know, sometimes the footnotes led to archived recordings of interviews. And I went to the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. I listened to some of those interviews on tape, which had not been transcribed. And you know, so I did that. I also reached out to a couple of Asian American queer academics that I knew of, just kind of through the grapevine, and they really helped me. And one of them introduced me to a couple of queer Asian American women who had grown up in San Francisco in the 1950s and 60s. And those women were very generous with me. And I met with one of them in San Francisco. She lived there. She still lives there. And she went to Galileo High School, just like Lily in the book. And she was grew up in Chinatown in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s. And she gave me a little tour of Chinatown and talked to me about her life. That was really, really wonderful because I had by then kind of imagined this character of Lily. And I was really astonished to find out that a lot of the things that I imagined mirrored this woman's experiences. So that really gave me a lot of confidence in terms of moving forward with writing the book.
Could you give us an example?
Well, you know, in the book, Lily is kind of, her community has this event they put on every year, the Miss Chinatown contest. It's a big local pageant for the local Chinatown girls. And it's a way to bring the community together. And these girls really are a representative of Chinese American pride at the time. And the woman I spoke to in who grew up in Chinatown, she knew many of these pageant queens. I think she told me that she had crushes on several of them, and her dad was involved in the committee to run the Miss Chinatown pageant, and they actually wanted her to run one year, and I don't think that she did. But it was really funny to find out that these things that I brought together out of my research really did kind of intersect in this person's life. Not that her life is not Lily's, obviously, but it was really interesting to see how these things overlapped.
At some point, Lily has to come out to her family, and it does not go well, let's just say that. I was curious whether this was something that you had experienced personally or more reflects just the way your character developed.
It doesn't reflect my own experience, actually, but it does reflect Lily. I've had to think a lot about what her family would have thought at the time. I mean, this is 1955 when her parents find out, and it's really not okay to be gay and at all in America at the time, and certainly not in the Chinese American community. They have a different relationship with homosexuality than I think white Americans do, but it's still not okay. So that was really a reflection of her context. And that's part of the reason I wanted to include scenes from her parents' perspectives in the course of the book, so that you kind of see where they're coming from once you get to this moment where they have this very clear conflict.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Melinda Lowe about her best-selling YA novel, Last Night at the Telegraph Club. You know, another thing you've written about on your blog, actually, was that the Daughters of Bilitis, which was the first gay women's organization that I actually knew about. I used to go in and volunteer at the Daughters of Bilitis when I was 16 years old.
Wow, that's amazing.
10 years after the action in this book, actually.
I love hearing that.
But what you're talking about is very real. It was really a hush-hush thing, even 10 years later, although, you know, things were about to change. But you said that the Daughters of Bilitis was actually, you know, co-founded by women of color, which was something I never knew.
Yeah, that was a fascinating thing for me to realize. And I don't think that the founders ever tried to hide that. It's just that the way they were represented in the media, those original co-founders kind of fell out of the organization. So they weren't really involved once the organization became what it became.
And it was very important. So talking about historical research, you also go into the history of women in jet propulsion at the time. So talk about this angle in the book, because it also, there's a theme of women being in non-traditional occupations for women at the time, not only rocket science, but also pilots.
Yeah, you know, before I wrote this novel, I read this book called Rise of the Rocket Girls by Natalia Holt, and it was about the women computers who worked at the Jet Propulsion Lab in the 1940s and 50s. And I was really astonished to find out that several of these women were Chinese American. One of those women became a supervisor who then went on to hire many more Chinese American women to work as computers and later as engineers at JPL. So I found that really inspiring, and that is what really inspired the character of Lily's Aunt Judy. And, you know, I didn't know this history. I don't think that many of us knew this history growing up, and it's been really wonderful to see that women were at the forefront of rocket science. You know, way back then, they were doing the math. They were literally doing the math. So I found that really incredible. And so Lily's friend Kath at school really wants to be a pilot. And I found that that was one thing that could bring them together, because that was also kind of a field that women were not supposed to be in. Although there were, of course, many early women pilots like Amelia Earhart, who went on to become incredibly famous and very inspirational to generations of women. So that's where that came from. And I kind of have this idea that their life goals, you know, to be scientists and pilots, they kind of work together. And they work together personally and also professionally. And that's what kind of, I think, makes them have a chemistry as a couple in this book.
And also, I don't know if this is true for the rocket scientists, but did you find that there were, or at least hints of, gay women overrepresented among women who went into, who broke into fields that were traditionally closed to women at the time?
You know, I don't know. I don't have any actual numbers on that. And the books that I read didn't really go into it. And many of those women at the time, if they were gay, you know, they were closeted. So people wouldn't necessarily know. I have my personal ideas about it. You know, I absolutely believe that gay women would be more likely to go into those careers. I mean, I feel like they always have been. So personally, I believe that would be the case, but I don't think I have any actual hard data to prove my belief.
And Melinda Lowe, in this novel, Last Night at the Telegraph Club, another theme is the McCarthy era and the pressures on immigrants, on naturalized citizens to inform on other people, to toe the line. Talk about that aspect of the book.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I based Lily's family kind of on my family, but the opposite. So my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, met in the U.S., but they went back to China after World War II, and then they were kind of stuck there until 1978. So I imagined, you know, what if they had stayed in the U.S.? And that was really the inspiration for Lily's family. And World War II then becomes the reason Lily's dad can stay. He enlists in the military to gain citizenship. And when I was researching all this stuff about Chinese immigration, I really didn't realize that the 1950s were quite a xenophobic time for Chinese Americans because of McCarthyism, because of the rise of, you know, quote unquote, Red China. There was a lot of anti-communist fervor. The Korean War had happened, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service was really out to get Chinese Americans. They had this thing called the confession program, where they encouraged Chinese Americans to confess if they had come to the country illegally, as many of them had done, because Chinese were excluded from immigration all the way through World War II. But once they confessed, then the INS could then go and deport their family members. So it was a really difficult time. And in the research I read on this time period, the INS and FBI agents would literally stop people on the street in Chinatown and harass them and ask for their papers. It really was very much part of the community experience.
Yeah, that was a terrifying time, actually. Of course, this is a terrifying time, too. But
Yes, there were many, many echoes. When I was writing this book, there were many echoes with what was happening today.
Oh, say more about that.
Well, you know, I basically wrote this book during the Trump administration. So it was a very strange thing to be reading about all this immigration harassment and then be in 2018 or whatever and see it happening on TV with the putting those children in cages on the border. I mean, it was really horrifying to see that in many ways our country had not learned its any lessons from the past. And we just continue to repeat these things.
Now, back to the Telegraph Club. There is a raid. You did base it on an actual raid.
I did, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that one.
Yeah, so in the mid-1950s, San Francisco started to crack down on gay bars. There was this period of time in the early 1950s, like 1950 to 54, where there was kind of a heyday of gay bars. They were not raided as much because there had been a Supreme Court decision, I think a California Supreme Court decision, that basically legalized assembly of homosexuals in public places. So it was okay for them to go to a gay bar. But then in the mid-1950s, there was a new mayor in town, and he started cracking down on so-called vice. And they began to raid these bars because even though it was okay to be in them, it was not okay to have any homosexual activity. So there would be police officers undercover pretending to be gay so they could, you know, entrap someone. It was really kind of awful. And one of the bars they raided was owned by this person, this lesbian named Tommy Vasu. And she owned two bars that were connected in San Francisco. And one of them was called 12 Adler. And that bar still exists. It's now called Specs. And it's, you can go visit it. And which I did when I was researching this book. The other one no longer exists. But they raided this bar. And during the raid, they discovered several teenage girls there. So they were obviously not of legal drinking age. And these girls were forced to testify in court against the bartenders who had served them unknowingly, I would assume. But also, I just had to think, these bartenders, even if they had suspected, you know, this was a lesbian bar, they probably knew these girls were there for a reason. It was a community place for them. And the testimony is just so sad. Like, if you read about it in the paper, the girls seem so depressed and so upset about having to do this testimony. And this raid was splashed all over the news in San Francisco. It was very salacious. And so that really was the inspiration for this raid, but there were many more that happened.
Yeah. And talk about this as a community center, because you draw a line between raids of this kind and clubs of this kind to the, you know, the founding moment of the gay liberation movement in New York. At Stonewall. You don't draw a line in the novel, but in your writings on your blog. So talk about the raids and how they politicized a movement.
You know, the raids in San Francisco that I knew of, it did. I can only imagine that it brought the community together because these were places that you went to meet your friends and to be free with them. And to have the police disrupt that experience was obviously terrifying and infuriating. And, you know, people talk about Stonewall all the time. I do know that there were earlier raids and earlier protests also involving trans activists and drag queens, like the Compton Cafeteria riots in San Francisco. I think that was in the 1950s or 60s, before Stonewall. These things were happening all over the place. It was certainly not a rare occurrence. So it gives you something to organize against, you know, even though it is obviously very dangerous to do that.
And now I hear that you are working on a companion novel to this, A Scatter of Light. What do you mean by a companion?
Well, that's interesting because it is set in 2013, so 60-some years after Last Night at the Telegraph Club. I would say it's set in the same world. So some of the people from Telegraph Club will be in A Scatter of Light, but they're very different books. Obviously, 2013 is not necessarily a historical novel, although it is set in the past. It's an interesting book because it's a coming of age novel again. And the main character is similarly very fascinated by space science, but the books are so different. And I want to make sure that readers who pick up A Scatter of Light understand that it is not the same as Last Night at the Telegraph Club. Interestingly, I wrote A Scatter of Light first. I didn't think it was going to be published, honestly. And it was while I was writing A Scatter of Light that I realized the two books are connected. And after I finished Telegraph Club, then I revised A Scatter of Light. So it's a bit different now than it was when it started, but it is still at its heart the same story.
Well, I hope you'll come back on Writer's Voice and talk to us about A Scatter of Light when that's published.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And in the meantime, this book, it won the National Book Award, and now it's been reissued in paperback. Is that correct?
Yes.
This has just been delightful to talk with you, Melinda Lowe, about Last Night at the Telegraph Club. It's a terrific read, not just for young adults, for older adults like myself as well.
Thank you so much.
In addition to writing fiction and nonfiction, Melinda Lowe writes a biweekly newsletter on writing and culture, Lo and Behold. Listen to an excerpt from Last Night at the Telegraph Club at writersvoice.net. Next up, the Bad Muslim Discount. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Following two families from Pakistan and Iraq in the 1990s to San Francisco in 2016, Syed Massoud's new novel, The Bad Muslim Discount, is a poignant, funny, and profoundly human novel about Muslim immigrants finding their way in modern America. It's also a window into how people in the Muslim world view America, how Americans have little notion of the diversity of views in the Muslim world, and finally, how human beings everywhere are more like others than different from them. In addition to The Bad Muslim Discount, Syed Massoud is the author of two other novels, Sway and More Than Just a Pretty Face. Syed Massoud, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The Bad Muslim Discount follows two families from Pakistan and Iraq from the 1990s to San Francisco in 2016. First, just to get us right into it, tell us about the two protagonists. Tell us about Anwar from Pakistan and Safwa from Iraq. And should I call her Safwa? Because she changes her name in the book, and I'm not sure which one to use.
Yeah, most people do call her Safwa, so let's go with that. She has three names in the book. It's one of the challenges of that particular character, I think, when we talk about her. But, you know, Anwar is a young man growing up in Karachi, Pakistan in 1995 or so. He's a teenager and he's just trying to find his identity when his family decides to move from Pakistan to the States. And he's sort of the black sheep of the family, very sarcastic, sort of cynical, and the sense that he's better than most people he encounters, or at least smarter than them, if not better, I should say. Whereas Safwa has a very different story and journey. She grows up in the shadow of the invasions in Iraq, and then has a very closed world because of who her father is. You know, he sort of keeps her at home sometimes against his will, in fact, because of the situation in the country. And then ultimately, they have to flee their home, go to Afghanistan and Pakistan's border there, and then they make their way to the States as well. She's more fiery, more determined than Anwar, who's more of a lost soul. She's more take charge. So they're sort of opposites in that sense, whereas he has a bit of a Hamlet quality about him. She knows exactly what she wants, and she's determined to get it and make her own fortune in the world.
And now I want to go just briefly to you. You grew up in Karachi, Pakistan. You've been the citizen of three countries. You live in Sacramento now. You've lived in eight other cities. You're a kind of citoyen du monde. You write about yourself that living among different people in different countries at fascinating times in their histories has shaped both your view of the world and your writing. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the gifts that I have had in my life is, you know, sort of by providence, really, and the decisions my parents made, is that I've lived in different places. And, you know, you get an interesting view of humanity. When you're living in, let's say you're living in Pakistan, especially when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, there's this sense of, you know, we're different, we're special, and a sense of destiny and the idea that, you know, you're patriotic and you love your country. And then you go to a different country and they have the same views. And then you go somewhere else and they have the same views, you know. And you begin to realize that people everywhere are the same. And the humanity that unites us is driven by really basic needs, the need to be loved, the need for food, the need for shelter. That's really what people care about at the end of the day. And everything else is sort of window dressing, and there are differences and culture is important, but the basic humanity that unites us is the same everywhere. And that is a theme that sort of finds its way through all of my work, I think. And it certainly comes true in The Bad Muslim Discount.
Yeah, and say more about that aspect of it. How do you see that coming forward in this wonderful novel, The Bad Muslim Discount?
Well, one of the funnier things is most of the characters are Muslim, right? It's just one of the major things about the novel that just happened. I didn't set out to do it that way. But one of the more interesting parts of the novel for me was when the family, Anwar's family, moves to the States for the first time. And they try and adjust to life here. You know, it's seamless for most of them, except for Anwar's father, who struggles a little bit. And then one day he walks into an ice cream shop because he hears sounds of music being played that he's interested in, is jazz that's being played. And then he's able to connect with a stranger based on just music alone. And he finds a friend, and all of a sudden, this continent that is alien to him and foreign to him becomes home because the presence of someone who you care about and who cares about you can do that. So, you know, the idea is that there are things that supersede where we come from. And I kind of feel like we're in a very identity-driven portion of the human experience, you know? But I think there are global... Being human is also an identity, let me say it that way. And I think that's important to remember.
So we are unified in our tendency to divide ourselves off from other people?
Yes, indeed. You know, I think there's a lot of politics that sort of happens. You know, like when I was growing up in Pakistan, you know, everything bad that happened, we were told was India's fault somehow, or this fault of the United States. And then, so you were almost like, it's not that you were taught to dislike Indians, but sort of to dislike India, the country. And then I came to Canada and my family moved there, you know, and I actually met Indian people for the first time, though some of my family was from India. I'd never met them. And obviously they were exactly like me. And so, you know, I got to know them. I got to be their friend. I went back to Pakistan and I was mentioning this to somebody. And there was a person around like 40, 45 years of age who was so offended that I would say that Indians were just like us, that he left the room. Like he literally walked out of the room on me because he could not bear to be in the same room as me because I said something so scandalous. So I think, you know, we are taught to think things. And I think part of growing up is escaping what you've been taught. And I think part of Anwar's journey certainly is that, you know, is growing out of the dogmas of the past, let's say.
Yeah. And, you know, he's the, quote, bad Muslim, unquote. First of all, I want you to say, you know, what is a bad Muslim in terms of Anwar? But on the other hand, I mean, if you know anything about Islam, and I just know a little bit, he's a pretty good Muslim. He's compassionate. I think another character in the book talks about him pursuing a jihad in the best sense of that term. So explain what his jihad is, and you know, how is he a good Muslim? How is he a bad Muslim?
Yeah, you know, Islam is, all religions are really interesting to me. Islam in particular, because we have this idea of the great jihad. And the great jihad is the battle a person fights within their own soul. The battle of the soul versus temptations and evil, you know, and to prevail in that is the real thing. And the irony of the book is that while Anwar is considered a bad Muslim because he doesn't have the outward forms of practice and he's not interested in the outward forms of practice, you're absolutely right. But from any internal sort of compassionate point of view or emotional point of view, in the sense that he cares about not just people, but also really bettering himself. And, you know, he helps out a lot of people in the community. You know, he's actually more engaged than some quote unquote good Muslims are, but he doesn't have the outward forms of practice. And so that's why he's labeled a bad Muslim. And so I think one of the points in the book is that we often look at the exteriors of people and not their interiors. And so we don't know what they've been through and what has shaped them to be who they are. But because we only have the exterior, we don't know, we're not in any position to judge them necessarily. Or if we do judge them, we can't judge them accurately. And that happens with a lot of the characters that Anwar meets. And when he's thinking about Safwa, again, one of the parts I really enjoyed writing was, you know, when he's trying to figure this woman that he's sleeping with out, you know, he realizes that he will never really have her full story. And again, that's one of the major themes in the book, is that other people's stories are always incomplete for us because as human beings, we struggle to understand ourselves, much less other people. And so the bad Muslim discount, there's some irony in the title, as you can tell.
Yeah. Yeah. And Safwa, you know, her story is a lot darker. She's a more conflicted character. And yet she has incredible strength to her. You know, I think another character calls her a serrated knife. And he's actually meaning it in some perverse way as a compliment at the same time as he's trying to hit on her. Talk about Safwa as a Muslim woman. And, you know, what animates her, the transformation that she goes through as a result of, you know, really terrible tragedy in her life?
Yeah, I think the women, the Muslim women in this book are really diverse, which was really cool that I got to do that. You know, you had Anwar's grandmother, you have Anwar's very powerful mother, you have the sort of the love of his life in Zuha. And then you have Safwa. So you get like a broad spectrum of experiences, right? And hers is, I think in some ways, more what you would see sort of expect from the West. But, you know, there's so much fire in her that she's able to fight her circumstances. And it doesn't always end well when she does so. You know, she in fact, at some point says something like, you know, every good thing that's happened to me has happened because I did it. But I've also made my situation worse by doing things, but that doesn't stop her from taking action. So she's a very dynamic character and a very interesting contrast to Anwar, because when I was writing them, you know, his parts were sort of light and fluffy because he was lost. And then her parts were, you know, pretty brutal at times, but then because of her agency, she was able to, I think, engage the readers by saying, you know, I'm not standing for this. Whereas Anwar's kind of like, yeah, this is sort of the way things are. I'm just going to run and hide. So I have a lot of admiration for this character. And I'll tell you, when I first wrote the book, I didn't have the last sort of epilogue at the end there where, you know, we'd find out what happened to Safwa. I had left it so that Anwar doesn't know, so the reader doesn't know. And my agent said, no. I need to know what happened to this character. So I went back and I put it in. But again, I think there is a there's a sense, I think throughout the entire book and in both characters, of taking charge of your destiny and not settling for the life that you're dealt. Anwar sort of learns that more towards the end, and Safwa always has that. And it puzzles her that he doesn't get it. So their relationship was interesting. And she's obviously a really interesting character because of how determined she is. I mean, she gets herself out of some really sticky situations, not unscathed, but ultimately she makes the life she wants.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm so glad your agent made you put that in. Because when I read that Anwar didn't know what happened to her, I was going like, oh no. And
you know, I always tell my team this, you know, it's like, I sometimes feel like, you know, it's like being in a band, but the lead singer's name's on the band, like to use the fictional one, it's like the Archies, right? And Archie's name's on the band, but there's like this whole team. And I think sometimes authors, you know, our name's on the book, but there's so many people involved in making it happen. It's astounding. And so from editors to agents, it really changes the book and for the better, you know, so I'm very grateful to have a great team.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Syed Masood about his novel, The Bad Muslim Discount. And I guess this wouldn't be a bad point to ask you what the title is about.
Well, another gift from my agent. I had written the book and I had called it Other People. That was the original title. And a movie came out shortly thereafter called Other People. And my agent didn't like the title anyway. And so she came up with a list of titles that she thought would sell better than Other People. And one of them was The Good Muslim Discount. And the other one was The Bad Muslim Discount. And I thought The Bad Muslim Discount sounded better. So we went with that one. But what it is a, there's two parts in the story fairly close together where this comes up. One is when Anwar is meeting a very eccentric landlord, you know, for the first time. And the landlord has heard of Anwar and the things Anwar has done as an attorney to help other Muslims. And so he offers him the good Muslim discount. The irony, of course, is that Anwar is not, by traditional standards, a good Muslim, like we already spoke about. So there's some irony there. You know, he maybe should have been offered the bad Muslim discount. But the other part of the story where it comes up is right before Safwa is sent to the same apartment building. You know, people sort of referring her over to this apartment, tell her, you know, is a place for damaged people whose opinions are discounted, or whose value is not known. So they're sort of like they're discounted people, you know. I think it goes to this question that's been plaguing Islam, or Islam's PR, as Anwar would put it, for quite some time, which is who gets to speak for the religion, right? Especially in the West, you know. Is it the pious imams who are going to get to speak for it? Or is it the agnostics or now atheists who decided that they don't believe in their religion? I mean, those are the two dominant sides that speak out all the time. But the majority of Muslims fall somewhere between those two extremes. And so those voices often don't get heard. And especially the voices of the quote-unquote bad Muslims who aren't always involved in mosques and who aren't always vocal about their religion don't get heard. So it's a little nod to the discounted voices, let's say.
So, you know, I read one reviewer on Goodreads who was very upset with you, and it was precisely around this. So I don't know if you've seen this, but
I don't read the negative reviews on Goodreads. My agent has told me to stay from Goodreads, so that's what I do. I do use it to log my own books, like, you know, like what I'm reading, but I don't read the reviews. But I've heard of the controversy, and I've heard that there's a lot of dialogue around it, and I'm glad because that's the whole point of fiction. So while I'm not involved in it, I'm aware of it.
and so she gets on you. I think it's a she, actually, so I'm not even sure. But she says the core of your message is that Muslims who practice their religion, I mean, I think she's unfair, but that Muslims who practice their religion are potential terrorists, control freaks, abusers, or righteous to the point of harming other people, while Muslims who don't have a strong connection to their faith, those are the only good Muslims. How do you respond to somebody who says that? Where are you coming from?
So first of all, I think one of the heroes in the book is the landlord, who is a good Muslim, who is by traditional standards, is connected to his faith, is connected to his mosque. He's the one who rescues Safwa, really, you know, in a very literal sense once, you know. So he's a very positive character overall, and he's a good Muslim. I also think there, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, where we're living in an identity-driven age. There's this thing that happens when you're writing as a Muslim writer, where people sort of expect you to have the great Muslim character, you know, this one character who sort of can stand in for the religion and say, oh no, this is not how things are supposed to go, you know. But the fact of the matter is that the view of the novel shows very flawed people all across the spectrum. Yes, a lot of the religious characters are very flawed, but the non-religious characters are also very flawed. And, you know, Anwar is a very flawed person. Safwa is a very flawed person. And so, you know, I don't, we need to move beyond the idea, because it's a burden that's not placed on other writers. No one goes to Stephen King and says, hey, write this paragon of what it means to be whoever you happen to be into your books. I think it's an unfair expectation, because that's not the purpose of fiction. Ursula Le Guin once wrote, you know, I'm not a preacher, I'm a fiction writer. And that's sort of how I feel about it. So it doesn't bother me. I'm glad there's a conversation around it. I do think we need to move beyond sort of the expectation that books written by Muslims need to portray Islam and model it for the outside gaze. And also from the idea that somehow we're supposed to educate people about the religion. I mean, you know, Ayad Akhtar, I was speaking to him on an interview, and he said something like, you know, if only, he was talking about how many people write to him, how many Muslims write to him and say, oh, you're such a great writer, if only you would use your writing for good and to spread Islam. That's not the point of what we do. So I appreciate the criticism. I understand where it's coming from. I'll also say this. Morally upright characters who follow any religion perfectly are of no use to me as a novelist, because they're not flawed enough to be interesting. You know, there's very little character growth that can happen if a character is already a really good Muslim, right? Or a really good Christian, or a really good Jew, or a really good Hindu, or a really good what have you. Because the idea of religions is aspirational. It's to become a more perfect human being. But that's a little boring to me. So I'm always interested in flawed people. My books are all about flawed people. It's not meant to be an indictment of religious people who I think are aspirational, and people should aspire to be good. I think all religions do that, but I don't think good literature does that.
Well, that's a great answer. And it brings up other questions for me, because you mentioned Judaism, Christianity, Islam. They all have now gone in a very distinctly fundamentalist bent. I mean, I'm Jewish, and I grew up in a liberal tradition of Judaism, which was all about fighting for social justice. And I look around me aghast to see how fundamentalism has been turned to the most xenophobic, you know, cruel, brutal uses, for example, in the occupied territories in Palestine. And the excuse is that religion has been fundamentalist religion, that is, the people who are supposed to be the best practitioners, what they're making of their religion seems to utterly pervert it. I think you've seen that progression, and certainly that's expressed in the character of Anwar's father, he's a good Muslim, but fundamentalism comes to Pakistan and he can't breathe.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There has been this, let me put it this way. When I was growing up in Pakistan, and I know people, there are still people like this out there, I still have these conversations about this idea that there is some pure form of Islam or really any religion that you can return to. The problem is that when you do that, there is, and there's a throwaway line that Anwar, in his typical sarcastic fashion in the book, says something like, you know, Islam was back and you know, rejuvenated. I guess throwing away 1400 years of progress will do that to a religion. Because what people don't realize is that a lot of work goes into a religion, right? I mean, it's not the original sort of tenets that hold it together. There's all these people who come who do this great work. I mean, the poets who have come before, the Muslim writers and authors who have been lost to history because they never wrote in English, you know, who've come before, and I'm sure it's the same for other traditions, they've done really important work. But when you read them now, it's actually astonishing. I mean, I read authors, you know, where some of the imagery is so homosexual, for example, that it would result in the author being executed by these people who are trying to claim that they're the perfect embodiments of Islam. I'm referring specifically to like the Conference of Birds by Attar, who was the guy who inspired Rumi, right? But these people would be killed by ISIS or ISIL or whatever they're calling themselves now. So, you know, it's the same thing that's happening to other religions. But I think there's a feeling that we were once great, and so let's return to that. You know, the sort of the make America great again, make Islam great again. And that's happening all over because everyone's been told they're special. And everyone's been told there's a destiny out there for them. And it's not working out quite that way. So how can we make it happen? And I think there's a lot of good work that gets lost when you do that. So I'm not sure if I'm answering the question. It's just, it's really sad and unfortunate because I think the idea of religion has become something that's set in stone. Whereas I think people before us understood it as something that was growing and still helping us evolve. I think that's been lost. And now it's being used. The religion itself is being devolved as opposed to helping it evolve.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Syed Massoud about his novel, The Bad Muslim Discount. I mean, there's a whole other theme that runs through this book that I think is so important for non-Muslim Americans to see. And you are really showing in many ways how people around the world and people in the Muslim world in particular view America. You know, for example, people talking in Iraq when Safwa is still in Iraq, just showing what it's like to live under the constant threat of being obliterated by a drone, you know, bombing you from the sky, you know, at one point, and speaking of Obama, you know, the drone king. And another thing that that really struck me is how before 9/11, Muslim Americans were just Americans who were Muslims. And after 9/11, that completely changed. So talk about what you would like readers to take away from what, you know, that is American non-Muslim readers need to take away from how other people see them.
Yeah, I just said I don't read good readers' reviews. I did see this one review on Amazon, but I saw one negative review and someone said, he or she said something like, it was a good book, but I found it insulting to my country. And I said, you know, I'm just stating what happened. You know? So what your country does, it's really more on the country than it's on me. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that the Muslim world has a complicated relationship with America. It really does. And I think you see that, you know, despite everything that's happening, Anwar's father has a great love for America, he always has. And so there is this aspirational America that is very admirable and really coincides, the rise of that America sort of coincides with a very unusual, historically speaking, freedom for Muslims, you know, because there is no caliph anymore. There is no great Muslim empire anymore, which means that Muslims today and how they practice their religion are freer than they've ever been because there is no spiritual enforcement, right? Historically speaking, it was not always like that. Sort of America's rise and America's purported values of freedom and the rise of freedom in the Muslim world have sort of coincided, and I'm not really sure what to make of that. It's just a thought that's coming to me as I'm speaking now. But I think that's part of the reason why the aspirational America is something that Muslims have always been impressed with. So there's admiration there. There's a long history of broken promises. You know, sort of America is always, you know, when you watch Hamilton, you see it too. You know, this idea that, hey, yeah, we made this promise to the French, but, you know, we're not going to keep it because it's better for us. And so there's this, historically, America has not been great about keeping its promises, especially in the Muslim world. So there's distrust there. And then after 9/11, there's a history of not just the violence and the drone strikes, but also sort of the strong arming of countries to make tremendous sacrifices. Pakistan's lost a lot of lives, you know, at the front lines of America's war on terror. So it's a complex relationship. It's not all negative and it's not all positive. But I think what Americans need to realize is that there's a sense in America of sort of the world revolves around us, right? But I think what we've been talking about throughout this entire interview is that every country teaches our citizens to believe that. And so when you see America not as the center, but on the margin as an outside actor, your view is very different. It's not all virtue and it's not all, hey, we're good intentioned, but we make mistakes. That's not always how the world sees America. Some parts of the world think that America is sinister. Other parts of the world think that America is great. But it's a complex issue. I just think people should travel widely. People should read widely and broaden their horizons. And they'll come to the place that we talked about where Anwar is, where he makes up his own mind about things. And I think that's really the lesson of the book and the lesson of this conversation, which is, you know, don't say Syed Masood said this, so it must be true, or I heard this from my government, so it must be true, or from my priest or from my imam or what have you. Make your own mind after reading about it, after thinking about it. And then what you decide, at least you'll be able to defend it better than, hey, my president said this, and therefore it's true.
A very important lesson, too. I mean, we're talking on the day after the anniversary of January 6th. You know, you're really talking about reason in the best sense of the term. People having open minds, people basing what they think on the evidence that comes to them. Syed Masood, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Syed Masood. Read an excerpt from The Bad Muslim Discount at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.